We have with us live in the studios once again, John Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, both with Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
All right, lots to cover.
We're still here.
We are. We are. We don't know how much longer.
Yeah, we are.
Cue the Blondie
and
song.
In this particular instance.
Or Prince.
We're, of course, talking about the supposed rapture that was scheduled for sometime this weekend.
6 o'clock.
We're not talking about other reasons why we're still here.
Yeah.
And why that might be surprising.
Let's dive in, and starting with the bus ridership.
Yeah, Metro reported this week that bus ridership is up on King County Metro, but Sound Transit reported that ridership is down on the Link Light Rail and the Sounder commuter trains. For Metro, they saw a 4% jump in April, and it's no mystery as to why there are more people riding the bus. All you have to do is look at the price of gas lately. At the same time, and you know, the recession as well, people are trying to save money. One of the best ways to do that is to leave your car at home. Sound Transit, on the other hand, is mystified as to why ridership is down on the commuter trains and why it has stagnated on the Link Light Rail. And so Sound Transit is going to pay two consulting firms up to $2.1 million in order to study why and how to get more riders on Link Light Rail and the commuter trains.
You know, I'd be willing to accept half that money, and I could give them...
Well, I'm about to tell them why for free, actually.
No. Oh, you're too cheap.
Oh, yeah, I know.
Costing us jobs.
But, you know... I just can't resist.
You need to charge for this expertise.
All right. It's no mystery. It's really no mystery as to why ridership has stalled on the Link Light Rail. For example, the business community in downtown Seattle insisted that the first line to be built for the Link Light Rail go from SeaTac to downtown. And they did that for a reason. It's because they wanted a way for tourists to get from SeaTac into downtown where they'd spend their money. Well, it's a recession, and of course tourism is down. And so it's no surprise that ridership on the light rail line is down. Hello. How hard is it to figure that out? As for the commuter trains, well, in the past month or two, we've had mudslides along the line from Seattle to Everett, one of the most heavily traffic lines on the commuter train system. But there's also other reasons too. All you have to do is look at the housing market. A lot of people, the lower income people who tend to ride the commuter trains and ride bus and rail, those folks have been taking the brunt of the bankruptcies in the housing market. You lose your house in Auburn. Where do you move to? Well, you move to an apartment that's closer to where you work. You move somewhere where there are apartments, and that tends to be, well, in the city. So it's no surprise that people are not riding the rail lines, which serve mostly routes like from Puyallup through Auburn, through Kent into Seattle. That's no big surprise. But apparently Sound Transit can't get their mind around that. And this week, Sound Transit announced that the South Extension for the Link Light Rail expansion will have to stop at Highline Community College instead of going all the way to Federal Way because they have a $3.9 billion shortfall in their $18 billion plan. Well, I have to say that spending $2 million to do unnecessary research may be part of the problem. You know, you don't waste money on stuff like that when the reasons are as clear as they are.
All right. Moving on. The vote coming up here soon about the tunnel?
Yeah, King County Judge Laura Jean Middaugh ruled yesterday that there will be a vote on the contract that was signed by the city council with the state regarding the construction of the replacement for the Alaska Way Viaduct. She made very explicit, however, that the vote itself was not a vote on whether the tunnel should go forward or not, only the viability of that particular contract. And there was immediately afterwards a press conference by four of the nine city council members, four members being the proponents, of course, including Council President Richard Conlin and Tom Rasmussen, at which they said very clearly this is not a an up or down vote on the tunnel itself, and we don't feel bound by the results of it. Now, we've already had an advisory vote on whether a tunnel is a good idea. We had it several years ago, and 70% of the city rejected the tunnel. So tunnel opponents are saying, well, we should have this vote anyway because it would constrain city council from moving forward with something that's clearly unpopular with the public. Well, as any student of city council actions in the past in this city, from stadiums to the advisory vote in 2007 on the tunnel, can attest, just because the public doesn't want it doesn't mean they won't go ahead with it. So we will be having a vote. The city council will act on Monday, almost certainly, to make that vote happen in the August primary, when the city believes it'll have a more favorable or at least unfavorable result because of the lower turnout during a summer primary. But at the same time, the city council is also making very clear that even if the Seattle voters reject, and even if they resoundingly reject the contract that the council has signed, that won't prevent the council from simply going ahead and signing another contract.
All right. Moving on, more arrests this week at the University of Washington?
Yeah, over the past 2 weeks, there have been some 40 arrests of UW students and occasionally a community leader as well. Rich Lang, a pastor at Trinity United Methodist Church, was among those arrested on the 19th, on Thursday. These are arrests having to do with the University of Washington's refusal to cancel its concessions contract, a $3.4 million annual contract with Sodexo, one of the largest international concessionaires, and one that has been criticized internationally for labor violations, mistreating its workers, trying to suppress unions, and so forth. There is a nationwide and actually an international campaign to try and challenge these contracts in different campuses around the country. And around the world, and the UW campaign has been heating up UW students against sweatshops and various other campus and community groups have been coming together around this. UW is still saying that it is not going to renegotiate the contract, which is up for renewal this year. And the actions as a result are likely to continue at least through the end of the school year next month. And after that, we'll see what happens.
I thought the contract was up for renewal in 2012. They had
they have to consider it this year,
yeah,
though,
okay,
for renewal.
Which means there's time for them to switch.
Absolutely there is.
Yeah, so there's no excuse for them not to announce now whether or not they would be willing to cancel the contract.
Oh, they have announced it, and they've announced
they
that they are not willing
no.
to.
Yeah.
Yeah, the regents have said so, and the UW administration has said so.
Which pretty much means that it's a done deal that they want to renew with Sodexo, which I think is pretty rotten considering what groups like Human Rights Watch and Trans Africa Forum have found to be evidence that Sodexo has violated labor laws.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. Moving on. Ohio Representative Dennis Kucinich coming to town.
Yeah, he's in town this weekend. He'll be at the Green Festival and a number of other events in the Seattle area. And according to Dwight Pelz, the chair of the State Democratic Party, Kucinich has called him and says he may run for Congress from Washington State in 2012. Now, it's widely anticipated that when Congress does its redistricting as a result of the 2010 census, Kucinich's district in the Cleveland area is going to be districted out next year, and Kucinich will lose his seat as a result. Rather than run for another seat in Ohio, he's looking at other possibilities of other areas around the country where he could possibly run, and apparently Washington State is high on that list, even though there will be...
We gain a district.
There will be two seats that are expected to be open and competitive in 2012 mm-hmm. in Washington State. One is the district that we will gain, the 10th district, which has not been drawn yet,
right.
But is expected to be on the north side of the east side, and will be carved out of existing parts of the 1st district and the 8th district around Kirkland and in that area.
Mm-hmm.
The other district is the 1st district itself, which is South Snohomish County, North King County, where Jay Inslee is currently the congressman. Inslee widely expected to run for governor next year, and that would create an open seat if Inslee runs. The problem, of course, is that both of those districts are much less progressive than, say, the Seattle seat that Jim McDermott holds, and much less progressive in terms of their politics than Dennis Kucinich is. The fact that he's been able to hold on to a district in Ohio for 30 years has probably a lot less to do with his politics and more to do with the fact that he has a local history there. He does not have a local history in this area. In fact, he would be widely seen as a carpetbagger, and widely opposed by certainly the Democratic Party establishment, who doesn't want any piece of Dennis Kucinich, as we've seen during his presidential runs. So I'm not exactly sure why he thinks he would have a good chance here. It would certainly be a media spectacle. Let's put it that way.
All right. Moving on, developments this week at the state level with medical marijuana.
Yeah, and a number of other things as well. The state special session is wrapping up. There are a lot of predictions early in the week that by Thursday they would have a deal on the budget, which is the whole reason for the special session, because of all the cuts that need to be done in the budget, because, of course, they've taken any kind of raised revenue off the table from early on in the process. And that budget deal has yet to happen as of last night, and so they're still working on it over the weekend. Meantime, one of the aspects of a special session is that any new legislation can also be introduced, and there are a number of bills that were introduced that are now languishing in the special session, because a lot of lawmakers just want to focus on the budget and they don't want the distractions of all these bills. The very watered down attempt to get some sort of a bill through on the medical marijuana dispensary issue is one of those that is apparently going by the wayside. It did not make it through the Senate committee last night on a vote. The voice vote seemed to be in favor, but then when they took a roll call vote, it failed. And so at this point, even the very watered down version, which would simply allow counties with over 200,000 population, which is to say Seattle, Tacoma, Spokane, and Vancouver, and I believe Thurston County is over that threshold as well, would allow those counties to set up their own systems. That's all the bill does, which is far less ambitious than the bill that was vetoed by Governor Gregoire a few weeks ago. Even that doesn't look like it's going to pass during the special session.
All right. And finally, Boeing subsidiary Jeppesen. Developments there.
Yeah, well, actually, no development at all. The lawsuit that was launched by the ACLU and other civil rights groups against Jeppesen for its role in extraordinary rendition during the Bush administration was suppressed by the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals last year, agreeing with the government ruling that the lawsuit could not go forward because to hear the lawsuit would be to reveal state secrets, which is the position of the Bush administration, and that Bush administration position was carried on by the Obama administration when it took office in 2009. Well, the U.S. Supreme Court let stand without comment that lower court ruling, and so that lawsuit is now dead, and we now have a precedent once again by which the U.S. government can do almost anything and justify it, or justify not having to defend it on the grounds that having to defend it would involve revealing state secrets. Very, very bad news for civil libertarians.
All right. Well, maybe we can move on to some happy news with this week's economic news.
No. Well, happy if you're rich. This week's retail
and
sales
aren't we all?
Report. This week's retail sales report showed that the rich are spending like it's 1999, while the rest of us are scrimping to get by. Stores like Saks Fifth Avenue and Nordstrom are reporting that wealthier customers are coming in to buy high ticket items at full price, and they're doing it in droves, at rates that they haven't seen since before the beginning of the recession. On the other hand, stores like Walmart, Target, JCPenney, which cater to those of us on the lower end of the economic scale, all have seen drops in the last month or two, even from early recession levels when retail sales were way down in the dumps. What they're saying is that folks who have a median household, the bottom fifth of earners, folks who have a median household income of about $9,846, are spending more than a third of their income just on food and almost 10% of their income on gas. And so there isn't a whole lot left over for them to buy anything else. Folks at the lower end of the economic scale are buying only necessities, and even then they're buying them in small quantities and in smaller packaging. Most disturbing of all, Walmart is reporting that they're seeing a trend that we've seen in grocery stores for the last 2 years, that people are spending money the first half of the month, but in the second half of the month, particularly the last 10 days or so, they're not seeing much at all in the way of customers coming in to buy even necessities, which means folks are trying to make what they bought in the first part of the month stretch through the entire month until they get their unemployment check at the first of the next month.
It also means they don't have any savings, and they're maxed out on the credit cards.
They're also
subsisting literally on the cash they have on hand.
Yeah, they're subsisting on the cash they get from their unemployment checks, and they're visiting the food banks. Food banks are also reporting a massive increase in the numbers of clientele.
One of the lessons from this is that when you hear national media in particular, but it's also done by cheerleaders like the editorialists at the Seattle Times, talk about the wonderful economic recovery, and we're hearing this, of course, from the Obama administration and D.C. pundits as well. Remember that most of those pundits and politicians are in the upper incomes and literally exist in a bubble where they're not exposed to how the rest of the country lives.
Yeah,
and they're fully convinced that there is a recovery because they don't simply understand that there's a difference between how they live and how everybody else lives.
Yeah, and they're following the stock market a lot of the time because that's where a lot of their income comes from, is in the form of dividends and interests and so forth on their investment holdings. A majority of Americans don't have investments, particularly now 2 years into the recession, when anyone who did have investments, even a small amount of them, cashed those in long ago in order to pay for necessities.
Yeah.
All right. Let's move on to international, starting with President Obama's speech about the Middle East this last week.
Yeah, it's been getting a lot of media attention, but you know, I didn't find a whole lot in the speech about, particularly the parts about Israel and Palestine that was new or different from past U.S. policy. The fact that Obama reiterated that the 1967 borders would be the basis for negotiations of territory for a new Palestinian state, and that there would be a lot of concessions made for Jewish settlements in the West Bank and Gaza Strip, that's not any different from past U.S. policy. And I was kind of surprised to see the New York Times, for example, make it sound as if Obama was saying something radical when he really was not. At the same time, what I found interesting is the timing of this speech and the fact that Obama clearly wants to head off a UN vote on recognition of a Palestinian state at the UN in September. And in my mind, that's the entire reason, really the entire reason for the speech at all.
And bearing in mind that vote at the UN will be of the full General Assembly rather than just the Security Council. So the United States does not have veto power over it.
Yeah. And the United States has said, well, if it were just a Security Council vote, sure, we would veto it, you know, as a way to reassure Israel that we're still on their side. However, it's supposed to be a full assembly vote, and it's very clear from the way the UN General Assembly has voted in the past that they would definitely support Palestinian statehood. In the meantime, there are rumblings of a third intifada to coincide with the September vote. And what happened on Sunday during the Nakba demonstrations, where we saw thousands of Palestinian refugees, unarmed, nonviolent, swarming Israel's borders between Jordan, Lebanon, Syria, and Egypt, and numerous demonstrations at various crossings in the West Bank and Gaza Strip, and that this took Israel entirely by surprise and the U.S. entirely by surprise as well. I think that's got some folks concerned in both the Israeli hierarchy and in Washington, D.C. as well, that they don't have a good handle on the situation and they don't have control.
Yeah. Meanwhile, we saw Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu at the White House yesterday issuing non-negotiable preconditions, those were his exact words, emphasizing why Middle East envoy George Mitchell had quit as something that happened actually several weeks ago, but that was only made public early this week. He resigned as Middle East envoy, which he was appointed in the first days of the Obama administration. This is a man who negotiated the Northern Ireland peace deal, who has a lot of experience as an international deal maker, who got absolutely nowhere for the simple reason that the Israeli leadership has no interest in a peace process. The peace process is a misnomer because one of the parties has no interest in dealing with peace.
And that's no change.
If anything, the Israeli leadership of both major parties has become more extreme over the past several years.
Yes, that's true.
But meantime, in the terms of the Middle East speech, most of the attention went to Israel-Palestine, even though there wasn't much new there. There were some new things on other fronts, however. Obama saying about Syrian leader Bashar al-Assad that he can lead or he can get out of the way, which is by far the strongest statement that Obama has made on the ongoing Syrian protests, which again, a number of people were killed by the security forces yesterday. But the real, what should have been the lead on this story was the initiatives toward Northern African countries and Middle Eastern countries that have tossed off their dictators this spring. There were $1 billion of loan forgiveness for Egypt announced in Obama's speech, another $1 billion in loan guarantees. There was a commitment to have the G8 come up with an economic stimulus plan for both Egypt and Tunisia. There was an extension of the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development to the economies of the new democracies in the Middle East and Northern Africa, and the announcement of a trade and investment partnership initiative in the Middle East and North Africa to promote trade between the region and the European Union. That's a lot of incentives that are being offered to countries who are considering setting aside their dictators, even as the United States supports those dictators in countries like Bahrain and Yemen and the United Arab Emirates.
I see it as a way for the Obama administration and the European Union to reach out to the potential new governments of countries like Egypt and Tunisia to kind of bring them into the fold. The worry, of course, is that Egypt could become a very strong power in that region, a non-aligned power, if they decide not to take advantage of some of these goodies being shoveled their way. And that could pose some difficulty for the Obama administration and for the European Union, who like to think that they control Middle Eastern politics.
Well, and the history of such dictators, not just in the Middle East, but in places like the Philippines and Chile also, is that the United States and its allies hang on to those dictatorships as long as they can. Mm-hmm. When it's clear they become feasible, then and only then they throw their support to the democracy movement, and then they try and co-opt that movement as soon as possible and bring things back to business as usual. That's exactly the model that we're seeing with Egypt in particular.
Yes. And then an additional bit of news in terms of Israel and Palestine. Some news came out of Turkey this week that another aid flotilla is being put together to head to the Gaza Strip at the end of June to try to break the blockade. So far, they have about 15 ships with 1,500 activists from over 100 countries taking part in this aid flotilla. So far, they're not looking for any additional ships or additional activists because they're planning that there may be more than one flotilla in the future necessary in order to eventually break the blockade, but they're not quitting.
As people may remember, about a year ago, Israel opened fire on international waters on the last major flotilla to do that.
All right. Moving on, Eric Prince, moving to the Middle East to set up shop.
Yes, Eric Prince, the former CEO of Blackwater, it came out in the press this week that he's been setting up a mercenary force in the Middle East to help dictators with potential uprisings.
I was surprised he's out on parole already.
Yeah,
His
new company, has he ever been? No, he hasn't been in prison. His new company is called Reflex Responses. He's taken $525 million from the United Arab Emirates to set up an 800-man force on their soil. The UAE has lots and lots of foreign workers, mostly from Pakistan and the Philippines, who live in somewhat squalid labor camps. And there's a worry that those folks may demand some rights in the United Arab Emirates. And so because they don't have much of a military or police force, they wanted to hire somebody with the expertise to set one up. However, there's the issue of legality here. It is probably, almost certainly, not legal for an American citizen to set up his own private offshore armed militia, regardless of who he's taking money from. However, the White House and Congress, the D.C. establishment, have not said that have not condemned Prince. They have not said that they are against it, but they've not given their official blessing, which in many ways is how a lot of covert operations work. There's a level of deniability, but nobody comes right out and says this shouldn't be going on.
I was going to say, what on earth makes you think that this isn't being done with the blessing of the United States government?
Exactly. Well, they won't officially say it, but my guess is, yes, it is got the blessing of the U.S. government.
All right. Moving on, the European debt crisis.
Yeah, there was a lot of talk this week. There's been a lot of talk, too, about restructuring Greece's bailout package. As we've talked about before, the bailout package was not a bailout. It was additional loans on top of the already heavy debt burden that Greece has. But of course, there are problems. Greece still cannot make the payments on its loans. Partly that's because the Greek economy is in such terrible shape, proving that the austerity measures that came with the bailout package are not anything that is actually helping the countries that are going through these bailouts being structured by the European Union and the IMF. Meanwhile, the Greek public is obviously the group that is paying for all of this. The economy in Greece was probably going to contract by about 4% this year. There's been a 25% increase in homelessness in Greece with no infrastructure or state money to help the homeless, because homelessness is not recognized as an official social problem in Greece, in spite of the fact that there are high numbers of homeless there. 250,000 private sector jobs have been lost in Greece in the past year. In a nation that is much less populous than ours, unemployment is above 15%, and Greeks are panicking and withdrawing their cash from most Greek banks, which is just causing more and more of a problem. In the meantime, this week, the best solution that the European Union finance ministers and that the IMF has been able to come up with is a possible restructure of Greek debt. In other words, moving the maturity of their bonds out further into the future to give them more time to pay them off. Fitch Ratings Company and the other rating services have said that is equivalent to a default, which meant that Fitch then turned around and cut Greece's debt rating by 3 levels, which means, of course, Greece is going to have to pay higher and higher interest rates.
It's a vicious cycle.
It is a vicious cycle. In the meantime, in Spain, which is next in line probably for a quote-unquote bailout from the European Union, tens of thousands of people are turning out in the street to protest Spanish government-imposed austerity measures. Spain has a staggering 21.3% unemployment rate, and it's not getting any better there.
And I hear the IMF had some other problems this week, too.
Oh, yeah, we're not talking about Dominique Strauss-Kahn.
All right, events.
Okay, several things going on this weekend. The Green Festival happening at the Questfield Event Center, $10 ticket for each day or $15 for the whole weekend. The U District Street Fair kicks off the season of street fairs and festivals and block parties for the summer also. It doesn't seem like summer today, but it will soon, hopefully. Also today, at noon in Tacoma, the annual Leonard Peltier Freedom March will start at Portland Avenue Park on Portland Avenue between East 35th Street and East Fairbanks in Tacoma. And then on Monday, May 24th, Wendell Berry, the legendary writer and naturalist from Kentucky, will be in town. He's going to be at Benaroya Hall at 7:30. If you at all have the possibility of going to see that, you should. He is amazing.
And the Seattle International Film Festival is starting for those of you who like to get your dose of international culture and see some good documentaries.
Yeah, bring a pillow to sit on. Do many. Talking as we do every week with John Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, both with Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
www.eatthestate.org is where you can check it out for local, national, international comics and news and views and blogs and all that kind of good stuff.